Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Princess Diana's tissue samples swapped at the post-mortem and she had almost no injuries in the crash itself. Further revelations about Diana this week. And we hear from the author of a new book, The British Cover-Up, Australian John Morgan. Plus, Tony Blair's press secretary, Alistair Campbell, and the head of James Bond's secret intelligence service, MI6, John Scarlett. Well, they've just been proven to have cooked up the dodgy dossier. With millions now dead and displaced, isn't it about time the pair of them went to jail for war crimes? Following the 7-7 inquest, also we have another untold story this week, not touched by the inquest people. That is the Israeli CCTV firm in charge of London Underground security at the time of the London bombings. And also Bristol City Council's statement on potassium iodate tablets just before the 7 o'clock news. They are front line of defence, these tablets, against radiation, so why have these once cheap and freely available tablets been taken off the market? But first, before all that, where are we going to discuss all this, if not on the radio? How about Bristol's very own Speaker's Corner on College Green? Stephen Perry is here to explain why old-fashioned face-to-face political hustings still matter in the city. Hi, Stephen, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Yes, thank you for the invitation.
Can you tell us what this Speaker's Corner on College Green is all about?
Well, it is a Speaker's Corner. I don't know whether the listeners have ever been to London and seen Speaker's Corner there, but by and large, that's how it operates. We provide a podium, a simple podium, a little bit of amplification to help cover the noise of the buses as they pass by. But really, it's just there for a good old rough and tumble to allow people, any people, a voice. I mean, coming into here, obviously BCFM offers quite a few people a voices, but they tend not to be Mr. and Mrs. Average. I'm sure they sometimes are. But if you go down to College Green, anybody on the spur of the moment can just chip in. For example, last time when we had a big discussion originally based around AV, it sort of wandered pretty freely in and out of that topic, there were a bunch of youngsters who often congregate on the green and they just joined in the end. And in fact, one Martin Summers really harangued one of them at great length and it was quite hilarious.
Okay, so what is the point of this, though? Because surely, you know, we've got all these discussions. This is a kind of... things have moved on since the days of old political hustings, face-to-face hustings. We've got these prime ministerial TV debates, all that kind of stuff happening now.
Well, tell the Arabs that. Just tell them that, you know, as they've gathered together using Twitter, using Facebook, using any other kind of social networking to get them there. Ultimately, people need to get together. They need to be able to express themselves directly. And if you bottle up, you know, people's voices and contain them and put them in studios and allow them the precious moments of one-minute statements if they go along to the council house to some kind of debate, you're asking for trouble. Here, people can come and say what they think. It's a kind of outlet, a healthy outlet.
Now, I mean, I think this is a little bit of a throwback here, because I've spoken to people back in Bristol in the 1960s and 70s, where up on Bedminster Down, apparently the weekends, a lot of the politicians regularly, every weekend, would go up there and they'd do something kind of similar. Tony Benn was apparently one of the particularly, who was a Bristol MP at the time, that used to do this. But you're actually now talking about bringing this down into the city centre. Are you getting any of the serious politicians involved, our MPs around the city?
Well, first of all, it's not aimed to serve serious politicians. We have had what you might designate as serious politicians coming down. I mean, for example, Charlotte Leslie was there for the No to AV campaign last time. We had a number of people from other parties, including, say, Gus Hoyt, now councillor for the Greens and so on, and a number of others like Paul Harrod. And in fact, Martin here spoke at some length. But that is not, and I repeat, not what this is about. This is primarily there for people who do not normally have an easy access to express themselves and their feelings. They could be feelings of anger, they could be feelings of joy, they could be bizarre, zany, whatever.
Oh, Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I hear you were up in this Speaker's Corner on College Green. In fact, I can remember seeing you on Points West ranting away. Do you think there's actually really any point to this, or is there really a need outside the sort of mainstream broadcasters and the newspapers to have these discussions elsewhere now?
Absolutely. I think this freedom of speech is a tremendously important thing. It's something that people take for granted, but it's actually a very, very important thing.
Well, you seem to be implying that we're not getting freedom of speech through these things like Newsnight and
we obviously have more control over what we're doing here, Tony, than we would if we were on Newsnight. The mainstream media corrals and domesticates debate, frankly, and certain subjects are not allowed to be talked about.
Well, one of the things I've noticed on Newsnight, for example, is that now there's all question of this whole Bin Laden killing a few weeks ago is off the card. It's assumed that exactly as the Pentagon and the White House told us, that's the way it is. And all of the discussions really now are based on that it is exactly as the White House said, whereas there's a lot of people out there with questions about
indeed.
It.
Indeed. I mean, and lots of people actually don't believe what the government's telling them about this, but you won't see that in the mainstream media, will you? Many Muslims are incredibly suspicious about every aspect of this. That's not in the mainstream media.
Can I just chip in there, Tony? Because I think, having been a journalist, or a retired journalist as I am, I know that the news media tend to develop a kind of narrative. And they all watch. They're obsessed by watching each other's output. Mm. And amazingly, if you watch the news, the running order is almost always identical. And so a view is taken as to how a particular topic is being approached now. Well, as I think Martin is suggesting, that doesn't happen at a thing like Speaker's Corner. It can come from any direction and any way.
Now, you mentioned young people stepping up to the microphone and getting involved the last time you were down there. So what kind of things were they, you know, what kind of young people were there and what were they saying?
Martin will probably remember this better because obviously to some extent I was involved with keeping an eye on what was happening next. But the youngsters, there were skateboarders there and just a bunch of people, young people about 16, 17 who were just hanging out as young people do and getting up and expressing their frustration on things like, believe it or not, cannabis. I think was one of the big things they wanted to talk about, legalisation.
Initiative.
So what's these sort of discussions? I mean, for example, on the drugs debate, do you think the youngsters have really making a good point?
Well, I mean, I think at first they were a bit sort of, oh, what's this? These old fogies getting up here having their silly opinions. But I think they actually got into it, and once they got into it, we discovered that they did have quite strong opinions about quite a lot of things, about the removal of EMA, for example, about the environment and legalised cannabis. Why not? That's many young people believe in that, but it's not a debate that we're allowed to have on television, is it?
It's silly because
it's immediately shouted down. Oh, shut up! What are you talking about?
I don't think it's so much shouted down, but there's this kind of anxiety. Oh my goodness, you can't talk about something like legalisation of drugs at length without there having to be some kind of balancing corrective view. It is just a kind of timidity that often dominates a lot of broadcasting. I don't see it as conspiracy, but I see it as a kind of riddled with conventions that need challenging.
Well, if I can put my National Union of Journalists hat on for a minute, I would say there's a lot of journalists out there who are literally living in fear of their jobs, and I actually quite often writing from day to day and thinking, well, hang on a minute, I don't want to upset the boss on this one, and that there is actually more editorial control and management control than there's been for a long time in this country, because of course journalists don't control the output, it's the editors and the managers that hire them that actually ultimately control that. So do you think actually that's one of the reasons why your Speaker's Corner has been successful is because that maybe the mainstream media is becoming a little bit too tame?
I think it is tame. If I could just go back to what I think is happening in news. I mean, a lot of this is actually much more depressing almost than you're describing. It is not some kind of awful Big Brother control from editors. It is that the journalists are given very little time and resource to do any particular piece. With rolling news, they're standing around just trying to be told, you know, being asked all the time to say what's happening without them ever having a chance to go and find out what is really happening. They're not given much time to go and talk to the general public and explore things in depth. And that lack of resource and yet the huge appetite for volume, I think has done a great deal to diminish the quality of news. That said, I think there's always been in British journalism a lot of sort of establishmentarianism in the way it is handled. Now, coming back to Speaker's Corner, we're still in our early days. I mean, this is only the first year, really, we've been operating. We started in March, and we had a couple of events then, and then we had last month in April when we did AV. And this time, actually, at the prompting of those youngsters we talked to who were standing by the podium, were looking at unemployment, youth unemployment they were complaining about in particular. And it was really suggested by them. We don't have an agenda at Speaker's Corner. I mean, as a human being, I have a lot of views, no lack of opinions. But in this sense, we are trying to be completely open. People have said to me, yeah, you can't have a guest speaker come up and then let them do whatever they want to do. And my view is, yes, I can. I'm not chairing it. I'm not trying to be Paxman. I'm not trying to be Tony Gosling, in a sense. I'm going to let the general public heckle, shout at them, stop them, tell them to get off if they've talked too long. That's the kind of control that you can get in Speaker's Corner that is completely different from other outlets.
Okay, so what's coming up?
Well, as I mentioned, the next one we've got is on worklessness. We've invited a whole number of organisations, ranging from business to the unions to people who work professionally to try to help young people. And for some reason, we've not, on this occasion, struck a chord in the way we have done with the previous events. It may just be serendipitous. It may just be because it's the wrong day, the wrong time. One of our problems is that we do it on a Saturday, when I think a lot of the professionals don't want to be giving their time working when it's their precious time off. Who knows? But the reality is, we'll be there, and we're there not for them anyhow. We're there for the people who happen to be on College Green. They may be passing by, whatever it may be. We let people know, and we try to do this through Facebook, through Twitter, and we hope that will grow.
So with worklessness, is that what you mean by that? Is unemployment, is it?
Well, I think it's not just about unemployment, if you use that term. I mean, I'm not sure that word is a rather sort of worthy to word, isn't it? But it's trying to embrace more, because some people can't work. What happens when people have nothing available, no means for them to work? It could be age, for example. You take the other end of the spectrum, where people have become obsolete, in a sense, or where they've lost the skills. So what is to be done about them?
Okay, Martin, can you just sum up here and give us a little bit of a rant about worklessness
Worklessness or unemployment will be the main issue tomorrow, I presume, but it will lead in all sorts of areas, because everything is connected to everything else, as we know. I think it's very important that we do build up a culture, a civic culture of debate and discussion. We're going to have one of the most serious social crises that we've seen in any of our lifetimes, and we need to talk about it. It's absolutely essential therapy for the society.
Martin, what is that social crisis that's coming, and why is it going to happen?
Well, we're talking about unemployment because we're talking about 1.5 million job losses in this country by the end of the year. That's going to affect an awful lot of people. They've all got families and so on. We need to talk about this, and we need to talk about it seriously.
Okay, could you just tell us where and when exactly again? Remind us where it's happening.
Right, it's Speaker's Corner. Do you know where the skateboarders are? Just by the cathedral there. We just put up our little podium there, and it's at 12 o'clock, between 12 and roughly 1. We'll carry on as long as people want us to, and just come along, pass by,
okay,
join in.
Stephen Perry, chair of the Bristol Speaker's Corner, thank you very much. You won't just finally tell us if you've got a website or contact details.
Well, we do. Our website is obviously www.bristolspeakerscorner.org.uk, or you can get us on Twitter. I'm not a Twitter person, but it's twitter.com/briz speak corner. That's what
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now, on to another story we're going to be looking at briefly. This is the Iraq dossier, which was drawn up to make a case for war, apparently, according to an intelligence officer. Now, this is Major General Michael Lorry, who gave secret evidence to the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq war, says, "We knew at the time that the purpose of the dodgy dossier," well, he didn't say dodgy, that was me, "was precisely to make a case for war, rather than setting out the available intelligence, and that to make the best out of sparse and inconclusive intelligence, the wording was developed with care. His evidence is devastating." And also he's saying that he is contradicting persistent claims to the contrary by the Blair government, and in particular by Alistair Campbell, the former Prime Minister's chief spin doctor. So this sounds like pretty explosive stuff, Martin.
Well, it's not really telling us anything we didn't really know already.
And it's hard evidence from the military.
Yes, we've got somebody else coming out of the woodwork and saying, yes, this was all cooked up.
It's not just anybody, though. This is a senior military officer, Major General Michael Laurie, is actually saying that Alistair Campbell's a liar.
Well, are we surprised?
Well, I think some people are. I mean, Alistair Campbell is rolled out day after day. We see him on our Question Time and these various programmes as pontificating on the state of the world and how we should do things. Do you think that's a good idea with someone like that? Or should he be locked up?
Well, I mean, all of these things have got to come out in the wash by and by, haven't they? There are still questions about the possible prosecutions under the Hague Convention. Let's not prejudice those by being too extreme, but let's let justice be done as it was done to Slobodan Milosevic and others.
Well, in the United States, someone called General Wilkerson, who's a retired military officer over there, has been saying something rather similar. But this is what he's saying about the Iraq War.
Know why Dick Cheney went to Iraq. The real reason for Iraq, and incidentally the reason we aren't coming home anytime soon, is the oil. The Iraq oil report made the projection that there's 100 billion barrels for sure, 200 billion probably, and at the outside 300 billion. That dwarfs Saudi Arabia.
So what do you make of that, Martin?
It makes one question what we're being told now. Is that lies as well? Are we being told the truth about Osama bin Laden, for example? These people have got a track record of lying?
So we're being told all sorts of things about this. Ultimately, why has it taken such a long time? What is it? We're talking about now eight years since the Iraq War, for the people who are responsible for criminal, I mean, you know, it's certainly war crimes, it certainly looks like, you know, over a million people killed and displaced in Iraq, and bomb attacks daily in Iraq, far worse than it was beforehand. It doesn't seem like there's any justice in the system. What can we do about it?
Well, the wheels of justice inevitably grind slowly. I mean, many of the warlords in former Yugoslavia, for example, got away with it for years and years and years. But I see that Cheka, who was Arkan's mistress, she's just been sentenced to a massive fine in Belgrade, not as much as she's stolen. It's a continuous battle. Berlusconi's going back to court. The police in Italy have been trying to catch him all along. A lot of these powerful people have very powerful lawyers. It usually takes a while to catch them.
But I mean, why does it take? I mean, this is the thing that irritates me. Is surely, certainly within a year. I mean, we're going to be hearing in a little while about the Diana inquest. That took 10 years to take place. Surely these things should just be happening within a year. Should happen straight away.
Well, no, because criminals are powerful. I mean, that's why they get away with what they do. It's a continuous battle. If you're especially wealthy criminals who are well connected inside the establishment, it's very difficult to catch these people. But the criminal justice process is the way to deal with them. Not through any other means, for example, bombs and shootings and so on.
Well,
the criminal justice process grinds slowly, but it grinds fine.
Well, talking of bombs and shootings, this time with NATO involved, is it possible that the Libya war has nothing to do with helping rebels or civilians and is really all about oil and banking? Let's have a listen to someone we've had on this programme in the past, Ian R. Crane, talking on the Russia Today about this topic.
In the Middle East have been unfolding at a phenomenal rate of knots. The ultimate target was indeed Libya all along. On January the 4th of this year, the UN was about to release a report praising Gaddafi as a model leader in the Arab world. Let's just also recognise one remarkable piece of coincidence. All of the countries that are tagged by the mainstream media on behalf of the political elite, all of the countries tagged, such as Venezuela, Cuba, Libya, Iraq, Iran, North Korea, all have one thing in common, or had one thing in common, and that is they are free of debt from the World Bank. They are not locked into the World Bank and the IMF. They have their own banks, they issue their own currency. And we also have to recognize the remarkable coincidence between Gaddafi's statement that he was going to start issuing gold dinar and demanding that his oil was purchased in gold. And then the next thing we know, of course, then we have a popular uprising. It was a brilliant strategy, because when Tony Blair and George Bush announced in 2002 that they were planning to regime change on Iraq, millions of people hit the streets across the Western world. But this time, the same is in process in Libya as was done in Iraq, what would that be, 8 years ago, in 2003. And yet this time, because, if you like, the scene was set through other popular uprisings, Libya just seemed to be the next natural part of the process. I think actually what's happening elsewhere, particularly in Syria, is deliberately contrived to take the attention away from Libya. The goal is Libya. The goal is control of not just the oil in Libya. Libya's debt was less than 1 month of its GDP. So it was no debt, that was just working capital. But it's not just the oil, because, you know, Gaddafi paid a social wage. Every Libyan of working age received the equivalent of $1,000 a month, and it was up to them whether they worked or not. So Gaddafi was putting money back into the community. All education was free. He was not in debt to the World Bank. I'm not suggesting that everything about Gaddafi was wonderful. The appropriate term to describe Gaddafi would be a benevolent despot.
That was Ian R. Crane speaking on Satellite Channel Russia Today earlier this week. Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, do you think it's possible that one of the reasons for the targeting of Libya is actually that it's outside this kind of World Bank debt system?
Well, I think that's exactly what it looks like. I mean, if you remember, as the crisis in Libya developed, I was very careful about what I was saying. I was willing to give the Western powers the benefit of the doubt. Perhaps there was a genuine uprising. Perhaps they needed a no-fly zone of the kind that we had in Bosnia when I was out there. But when we discovered a couple of weeks ago that Southern Mistral 2011 was on the French Air Force website, which was basically a war game to attack a North African country, which was clearly Libya, they've clearly plotted all of this in advance. And that must mean that the rebels in Libya were being armed and trained by Western intelligence services before any of the protests began in the rest of the Arab world. I'm in favour of freedom everywhere. What we need in Libya now is a ceasefire and negotiations, which will probably lead to change of regime, but in an orderly fashion. The Gaddafi regime clearly does have mass support, especially in the west of the country. There is no way out of this now. It's a stalemate. There's got to be discussions. But the West are preparing an armed a land invasion. And when that happens, we will see a proper war. The Libyan state will not just collapse.
Well, on to our 7-7 inquest review now. And following that 7-7 inquest, which took about 8 months, I think, summing up last week, we have another untold story. That is the Israeli security firm behind the London bombings. Four bombs exploded in London on the 7th of July 2005 on the public transport network, three on tube trains and one on a bus. But still, not a single CCTV frame has been released that puts the alleged bombers into those places at those times, i.e. the tube trains or the bus. Tonight we take a look at the scope of the inquest, which has just finished, and the Israeli security firm that should have produced those pictures but didn't. First of all, Martin, what do you think of the significance of the fact that this inquest had no jury? Because all juries are supposed to have an inquest, aren't they?
Well, I don't know about the rules of juries and inquests.
Well, the reason that you're allowed to not have a jury is if you think that the matters are too complicated for a jury to understand, and that's what was argued in this case.
Well, it may be so. One of the things, I've got a quote here from Lord Justice, whatever her name is, Lady Justice Hallett.
She said, yeah, she was the coroner.
She's the coroner. She says,
presiding
over. And she says here, I cannot consider the issue of preventability one of the most important of the issues I have set without stating in positive terms that they were the bombers. To argue or find to the contrary, i.e. that Khan, Tanweer, Hussein and Lindsay were not the bombers, would be irrational. It would be to ignore a huge body of evidence from a vast array of sources. Had there been a conspiracy falsely to implicate any of the four in the murder plot, as some have suggested, it would have been of such massive proportions as to be simply unthinkable in a democratic society. Now, in other words, she's ruled out in advance any questions about this as a potential false flag terror event. And I think that's completely absurd, and people shouldn't imagine that they have been told the truth about what happened on the day, because one of the main theories about what may have happened on the day is exactly what happened in Bologna Railway Station in 1980, when the Secret Services bombed the railway station, killed 87 people, and it was blamed at the time on fascist terrorists, but they were linked to the state. Now, if you're not prepared to consider the state as a potential suspect, then the investigation is simply not adequate.
One of the things that troubled me most about all this is this company Verint Systems, which has a contract to run CCTV on about half and certainly the central part of the London Underground network. Do you think there's actually any problem about private companies running these systems, Martin?
Well, I think we need to stress to people think they have seen CCTV of the bombers on the day. What they have seen is CCTV footage of the dry run carried out by the bombers the week before. no CCTV footage has ever been shown showing them out, in the places on the day. And we've actually got eyewitnesses, and that came out through the inquest, who said, well, they didn't see anybody. And we've also had other people saying that they didn't see anybody at all, and that the bombs were under the trains. Now, my copper's guess about this is that these were a jihadi group, but the jihadi groups themselves could be being manipulated by the security services. That was certainly the case at Bologna in 1980.
Well, it was certainly the case at Finsbury Park Mosque.
Indeed, indeed. So what we've got to actually look at, and of course we've not had a criminal investigation of any of this, yeah? Well, this inquest is not a criminal investigation. A proper criminal investigation would look at everything to do with this, look at the jihadi group itself, and of course look at who their leaders potentially were. Haroun Aswat was named by the Metropolitan Police as the mastermind at the beginning of the investigation. He was then whisked into preventive detention.
He was from Finsbury Park Mosque. He was
indeed,
Abu Hamza's
indeed,
right-hand
indeed,
man.
And named by the Americans as an MI6 double agent. Now, people in Belfast know how this works, and they know what a serious inquiry is and what a serious inquiry is not. This is not a serious inquiry, it's a cover-up.
This company I just mentioned, Verint Systems, the chief executive, Daniel Bodner, he's a former engineers officer in the Israeli army. And to be fair, all Israelis have to do their national service. But the parent company is possibly more worrying, called Converse Technologies. Their chief executive, Kobe Alexander, is on the run, having absconded with $13 million. And he's on the run, basically, he's been chased by the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States, last heard of in Namibia. The company, Verint Systems, used to be called something else. It used to be called Converse Infosys, because it had to change its name after a massive scandal in 2001, where it was supplying software to the US FBI and other agencies in America, and it was found that this software was also being used to tip off mafia people that the FBI were investigating. So as soon as the FBI started to investigate them, using this software, hacking in or whatever it was doing into the telephone systems, the mafia would then swap their phone numbers, swap their phones, and change all their behaviour, because they were getting tip-offs that this software was being used to put them under surveillance. This is an Israeli-based firm, which I think is quite surprising that an Israeli-based firm run by a former Israeli military army officer in the engineers is actually doing the CCTV surveillance on the London Underground.
Well, I think most people in Britain would be absolutely nonplussed to find that. They presume that the CCTV on London Underground is run by London Underground, but it isn't. And of course, the Israelis infiltrate themselves into security all over the world under privatisation regimes, so that they control, for example, it was an Israeli firm that controlled the security at Schiphol Airport, where the so-called underpants bomber was whisked onto the plane without being checked at all. Now, we sound as if we're talking crazy stuff here, Tony, but it's not crazy stuff. Basically, we need an independent police force, because in terrorist events, at least 50% and probably more of them are run by state security agencies, whether it's the FSB in Russia, Mossad in Israel, or our own dear MI5 and MI6.
What about the private companies like XE, Blackwater, people like that?
Well, of course, what you've done is you've created a whole unaccountable security industry.
Now, the thing with Blackwater is that they actually advertise that we will help you fight nuclear wars. They say we are the experts in nuclear war fighting, and we will contract out our services to you if you want to fight a nuclear war.
Well, all of these things need to be properly investigated, and that is why we set up the Police Service of Northern Ireland in Northern Ireland with the support of the whole community, because it's got to be the police who lead the investigations, and if it leads back into the security structure of the state, then so be it. Brigadier Gordon Kerr, as far as we know, is still in Iraq running the Joint Services Group. Nevertheless, he is wanted by the British police as a terrorist in Northern Ireland. He should be brought back and put on trial at Belfast Crown Court. He won't be, but he's not going to be able to come back. He's going to have to stay in Iraq to avoid that outcome. Now, we've really got to get to the bottom of what this terrorism game is all about. And a lot of it is definitely, in fact, being run by security services. The Gladio network in the 1970s and 1980s, operating in Italy, the Brabant massacres in Belgium.
Well, that was being run by NATO, wasn't it?
Indeed, run by NATO. Now, the fact is, this is not conspiracy theory. This is what I stress to the listeners. This is not conspiracy theory. This is documented historical fact that our own intelligence services have been involved in drug running, murder, and terrorism. Now, nobody has ever been punished for any of these things. That is why they carry on doing them. But that's why we need independent police investigation.
Well, there was a bit of punishment, wasn't there, in Belgium, actually, in Switzerland and in Italy too, because there were proper parliamentary inquiries into these Operation Gladio attacks in all those three countries.
There were proper parliamentary inquiries which concluded that the secret services were involved in all of these terrible incidents, but no individuals were held responsible. And that's not much of a deterrent to them, is it?
Well, on to the Diana cover-up now, and the date was the 30th of August 1997. Princess Diana was dining at Paris's Ritz Hotel after making final arrangements to announce in London her engagement to Dodi Fayed, a Muslim. Small wonder then that the British establishment were agitated. Indeed, Conservative Armed Forces Minister Nicholas Soames allegedly threatened Diana to stop campaigning against landmines because an accident could happen beforehand. Echoes of Spycatcher here, with these books by John Morgan now being published in Australia that rock the British establishment. Anyway, John Morgan has decided to focus on witness testimony in his latest book, and I spoke to him 2 days ago.
Yeah, well, I'm John Morgan. I've written a series of books on the Diana inquest, exposing a huge cover-up. The book that I've just recently finished was the fourth volume, focused on the evidence that was heard during the inquest in 2007-08 in London into the death of Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed. The books are also based on documentary evidence, none of which was shown to the jury during the inquest, but it's documents from within the British Paget police investigation. And when you put the evidence from the documents that the jury never saw and evidence from witnesses the jury never heard and put that together with the evidence the jury did hear, it's a lot easier to put together the story of what actually did occur. It was almost impossible for the jury to understand the events before the crash and also in the events after the crash, what actually occurred.
So what facts would you point to that might suggest a different verdict?
There's a substantial amount of evidence that the driver of the vehicle, Henry Paul, was not drunk. After the crash, an autopsy was done on the driver, Henry Paul, and it was made out that he was drunk, that the findings from the autopsy were that he was three times the drink limit in France. The evidence that was used for that is false, and there's a substantial amount of evidence that shows that there were two bodies in the autopsy room that night, and the samples were taken from the second body, which is not Henry Paul. Those are the samples that were tested, toxicology testing, and they gave a finding of a person who was drunk. But Henry Paul, on the night, there's substantial evidence showing that he wasn't drunk. In the Ritz Hotel, the witnesses have all said that he was sober, and the CCTV footage shows him sober. Also, the findings in the toxicology showed that the person who the samples were taken from had a high level of carbon monoxide poisoning, and that was not reflected in the actions of the driver on the night. A person with the level of carbon monoxide poisoning in the body that was tested and then combined with the alcohol, he wouldn't have been able to even get into the car. He would have been so disabled from it all. So if I was a lawyer, that would be the main point you'd focus on, because when you realise that there's a huge cover-up that stated that the driver was drunk when he actually wasn't drunk, you know, the truth's just not being told. And the accident wasn't caused by a drunk driver. Instead, it was caused by following motorbikes that were pursuing the car into the tunnel. And the motorbikes can be shown to not be paparazzi. The paparazzi were riding on scooters and driving small cars, and there was no way that they could have kept up with the speeding Mercedes. And there was about 8 or 9 witnesses that saw the motorbikes pursuing the Mercedes along the route. These motorbikes were powerful motorbikes. They were not bikes that paparazzi were using, and none of these riders on these motorbikes have been identified. There's about 3 to 4 motorbikes involved, and none of those riders have ever been identified. They left the scene of the crash. That's a cover-up in itself. No one's been held accountable for that. It's been made out that it was the paparazzi, and even when you look at the evidence the jury did hear, their verdict that they returned was unlawful killing on the part of the driver, but also on the part of following vehicles. But the following vehicles were unidentified, and yet the media around the world had reported it as paparazzi, and that's just completely false. The paparazzi were nowhere near the Mercedes as it went into the tunnel. The bikes that followed the car and pursued the car into the tunnel, they just weren't paparazzi. And police did their own tests on the bikes the paparazzi were using, and they didn't have the power to keep up with the Mercedes. The witnesses saw powerful motorbikes going into the tunnel, and the paparazzi were not riding powerful motorbikes. So they know which paparazzi were on that night outside the Ritz Hotel that pursued the car. Those paparazzi are all identified and named. They were not the people pursuing the car as it went into the tunnel.
What about this Fiat Uno? Have you come across any evidence that that was actually real and involved?
Yeah, the Fiat Uno is definitely real. There's paint from the Fiat Uno on the Mercedes. There's scratch marks on that, and there was definitely a collision between the Mercedes and the Fiat Uno. The Fiat Uno is covered in my volume one of my books. The evidence points to that being driven by James Anderson, who was a paparazzi who followed Diana on her holiday with Dodie just up to about 2 days before the crash. Then he went home. There's a lot of evidence that points to him, that it was his Fiat Uno. He owned a Fiat Uno that got sold within 2 months of the crash, and that Fiat Uno was the one in the tunnel on the night. And then James Anderson died a violent death about 3 years after the crash. His car was burnt up. The fireman that arrived on the scene saw two bullet holes in his head, and at the autopsy that was done in France established that it was suicide, which was absolutely impossible. For someone to suicide with two bullet holes and then have their car burnt up. The car was completely incinerated. It was just an unbelievable fire. So there's a lot of evidence that points to him being the driver. He had links to the intelligence, and certainly that it was his Fiat Uno that was in the tunnel, like the paint on the Mercedes matched with the paint that was on his Fiat Uno.
Is there any evidence that maybe more people would have survived the crash than actually did survive it eventually?
What happened in the crash was the two people who were on the driver's side, like the driver and then the person behind him, it was Dodie, they both died instantly. The two people on the passenger side, which was Trevor Rhys-Jones in the front, who was the bodyguard, and Diana in the back, they both survived the crash. That's because the impact was on the driver's side. So there's a photo showing Diana sitting on the floor of the car facing back. There's a photo of her, and it shows her quite alive. And also there's a lot of witness evidence that she was talking after the crash. And when the doctor got there, they did a Glasgow coma test, which is a scale of 15, and she scored 14 out of 15. So she was in fairly good condition as far as her head and that was concerned after the crash. And it's a Glasgow coma scale rating, which is used around the world by medics. When they arrive at a crash scene, they assess the victims, the people who are still alive. And out of 15, Diana scored 14. So it looks at things like, are they responding to me? Are they talking? There's 15 different points that it looks at. On the documentary evidence of the ambulance report, she says 14 out of 15. So it came out in the inquest, 14 is very high. And that's a very good reading. So it took the medics 1 hour 43 minutes from the crash to when Diana arrived at the hospital. So that is an incredibly long period of time. The evidence shows, it's in volume two of my books, that there's actually very strong evidence that shows that she was mistreated inside the ambulance on the night. So 1 hour 43 minutes, when you break it all down, every aspect of it took a long time. Like, it took too long to get her out of the car, 30 minutes or something, and then they were sitting in the ambulance in the tunnel for about 30, 40 minutes.
John, you've just said something pretty shocking there, that there's evidence that she was mistreated in the ambulance. Can you spell out exactly what you mean by that?
The first thing I should say is that when she's taken into the ambulance, the doctor assessed her condition, and on the documentary evidence of the ambulance report, it shows that they found a thoracic trauma. So she's undressed in the ambulance, and the doctor assesses her condition, and he saw a trauma on the thorax, which is the chest area. There was an internal injury there that eventually she died from. And when you look at the transcripts of what the doctor said to the base, this is amazing, but what he said was that there was a major head injury, which there wasn't at that stage because she scored a 14 out of 15, and he said nothing for the thorax. And he said nothing for the thorax twice to the people at the base. So even though they knew there was thoracic trauma, the documentary evidence is there, that they were saying nothing for the thorax. Now, that's weird anyway, because you'd be thinking they'd be focusing on what she has got, not on what she hasn't got. The reason that they were saying that was so when the base rang the hospital, they wouldn't be saying, get a thoracic specialist there, so that when she comes in, someone can look at the thorax. I know it sounds really bad, but when you look at the evidence, and it's all there in the inquest transcripts, that is what the transcript between the ambulance and the base, nothing for the thorax. That is very, very sinister. When you look at the length of time it took them, the 1 hour 43 minutes, and then when you realise that outside the hospital lot, they drove really slowly, and when they got to within sight of the gates of the hospital, within 500 metres of the hospital gates, the ambulance stopped for 5 minutes. There were two journalists that followed the ambulance in the evidence. They were saying that someone got out of the front, a doctor actually got out of the front of the ambulance and into the back. So already there was a doctor in the back. And when you look at the ambulance report, there are also two assistants in the back. So there are already three people in the back. And then a doctor got out of the front, not the driver, the doctor who was sitting on the other side in the front. He was sighted by a journalist getting out and getting into the back. So then you end up with four people. Then one of the journalists said he saw a rocking ambulance. You've got to ask yourself, why does the ambulance stop so close to the hospital anyway? If there's a problem in the ambulance, most ambulances would rush to the hospital and get it sorted out there. But they stopped. They stopped for 5 minutes. Now, there's been no realistic explanation. The doctor was asked about why he stopped. He just said it was to administer extra fluids because he thought that she might be approaching a situation where she could have a cardiac arrest. Well, that's not a strong enough argument, if you look at it medically, to stop the ambulance. They stopped for 5 minutes. Why did a journalist see a rocking ambulance, you know? What were they doing? He said that they weren't doing the heart massage. The doctor said that. So what were they doing that caused the ambulance to be rocking? And why do you need four people in the back for whatever they were doing? So it's not just that it took 1 hour 43 minutes, but it's what actually went on inside the ambulance that is quite distressing. I find that volume two, where it looks at the medical evidence, I find that probably the most distressing aspect of all my research, because really what you're saying is there's a lot of evidence that shows the crash was orchestrated, but this evidence shows that there was a backup plan. So she survived the crash, but then they actually manipulated the situation so that they had the right doctors there at the ambulance, that whoever was organising the crash controlled what was going on in the ambulance. And so they made sure that she was not going to survive that night. And when you look at the timing, it took them 1 hour 43 minutes to get to the hospital, and then 6 minutes later she stopped breathing, and she never recovered from that. Even though the official time of death was 4 o'clock Paris time, she actually died significantly before that. It was 6 minutes after she arrived she stopped breathing and never recovered. So whatever they did in the ambulance, she only survived another 6 minutes in the hospital. So then they spent another hour, an hour and a half trying to get her to recover, but she was lost. And they, by the time she got to the hospital, they had no hope, because she was in such bad condition. She really couldn't survive, and 6 minutes later she stopped breathing.
Have you looked into possible motives for a cover-up?
You've got really two aspects to it. You've got the relationship with Dodie. The other thing, which I think is probably more significant, is her involvement in the landmines. And when you look at the evidence, she only just really started getting deeply involved in that in January 1997, so that's just 8 months before she died. When you look back on the footage of that, she was walking in those minefields in Angola and in Bosnia, and nearly everyone who was alive then can remember that footage, and it had an impact. And this is what worried the authorities, I believe. She was calling for a ban on all landmines, and had she achieved that, and she didn't because the US ended up not signing the treaty, but had she been alive and continued to get public support behind that, then I doubt that she would have stopped at landmines. She would have been looking at other arms. And see, when you think about it, the French, if you look at my books, and part three really covers the French cover-up, the French are in this up to their necks. It happened on French soil. And there's a hell of a lot of evidence that shows French involvement in the cover-up, including the manipulation of Henry Paul's autopsy and stuff like that. So if the reason for her death was just the relationship between Dodie and Diana, and the possibility of Diana being pregnant, the French wouldn't be involved, because they are not that supportive of the royal family to want to get involved in something like this. But the French are in this cover-up big time, and they have a big-time arms industry as well, as do Britain and the US. And I believe that the people who brought this about, it was done by the intelligence agencies like MI6 primarily, and also the French, DGSE and DST, and also probably the CIA. The people that were on the ground running this. As to who actually gave the orders, I'm not sure yet, but I'm still investigating this. But the motives really get down to those two things, so the relationship with Dodie, but I think primarily landmines is probably even more powerful than that. And also there was evidence at the inquest from Simone Simmons, who was at Kensington Palace in February 1997, which was a month after Diana's trip to Angola, against landmines. And she was at the palace and a phone call came through. Diana answered the phone, and after she'd been listening for a minute or two, she beckoned Simone Simmons over to the phone, and both of them had their ears to the phone. And Simone Simmons gave sworn evidence that the person on the other end of the phone said she should stop interfering with the landmines or an accident could happen. That's a death threat. And Simone Simmons heard that, and Diana told her that the person was Nicholas Soames, the politician. And at that time, he was in the Ministry of Defence. He was the Minister of the Armed Forces. So that's sort of evidence pointing to landmines being a motive. On the other side of it, there's the letter that Diana wrote in 1995 to Paul Burrell, stating that she could die in a car crash, and that's actually the letter that got me, when I saw that published in 2003, that's what got me involved in thinking that there's more to this than what the authorities are saying. And because how can a person predict their own death and the method of death in a car crash? She was putting the blame on Charles. Well, I don't know. But the thing is that is how she died. So there's two sides to this. There's the relationship with Dodie and Diana, which is causing great embarrassment. The possibility of having children that would be related to the future king that were Muslim, that's a aspect that brings the royal family into it. Then on the other side, you've got the arms industry and the landmines, and the involvement of France certainly points to that. So there could be a dual motive there. The British establishment has been involved in a cover-up. The French establishment has been involved in a cover-up. This is a huge thing. This is just so big that it's just really incomprehensible that they are able to bring it about, but they have. And the evidence in these volumes shows that they have done that.
What's in your latest book, and give us the title?
The latest book is called Diana and the British Cover-Up, and that's about what happened in the 24 hours immediately following Diana's death. And what it shows, it's very shocking, but it shows that when you put the documentary evidence from within the British police files that the jury never saw, when you put that together with what the evidence they heard, it shows that Diana, her post-mortem samples in the UK were switched, and that the samples that were toxicology tested were not from Princess Diana. The evidence is very clear, and the thing is, the jury weren't shown the post-mortem report or the toxicology report. And if they had seen those, they would have seen the toxicology report said that there was no embalming fluid and no alcohol in Diana's blood, and yet she was embalmed in France earlier that day. So how can you have a person embalmed and have no embalming fluid in the samples? That's just one aspect. There's actually about 10 or 12 different points that point to the samples that were tested not being Diana's. Now, the other aspect to this is the involvement of the Queen in controlling events. Within 30 minutes of the crash, there's actually circumstantial evidence showing that there was a phone call made to organise the French embalming. That was made to Kenyans who used to be the funeral directors for the royal family, and Kenyans was part of the French company that actually ended up doing the embalming. So see, Diana wasn't a royal in 1996. She had the royal status removed, the HRH was removed, she was no longer a member of the royal family, and yet within hours of her death she's got the royal standard on the coffin coming out of the French hospital. That's what's on the cover of the latest book. There's other things like the Royal Coroner ended up taking jurisdiction of the body. That was illegal because on the first day after the death, that same day, Sarah and Jane, her sisters, had told the coroner that Diana would be buried at Allthorpe, and there's documentary evidence showing that's in the book. And yet the coroner went against that because the British law says that the jurisdiction of the coroner is based on where the body is to be buried. And the Royal Coroner took jurisdiction illegally on the day. So these things are all based on control coming from Balmoral, the fact that the Royal Coroner had control, that gave him control over what happened in the post-mortem and the switching of the samples. And there's a lot of shocking evidence in this latest volume, but it's not talking about what happened before the crash, it's talking about what happened in those 24 hours following the crash, and how Diana suddenly became a royal when she wasn't a royal. She was, you know, Charles got sent over to Paris. Well, Charles is the ex-husband, you know. Charles is in the letter saying, he will bring about my death in the car crash, and yet he's the guy that's sent across to pick up the body and bring it back to the UK. Once again, it's putting the royal stamp. See, the British people would have thought, oh, this is great. It's a patch-up, you know, like the royals have been against Diana, and now they're actually befriending her, but she's dead. People would have thought that was good. The people converging in London who wanted the Queen to come down and that they would have thought, well, it's great. The Queen is now accepting Diana. She's put the royal standard on the coffin. But it's all part of getting royal control so that the coroner could take a legal jurisdiction, and therefore they could control what happened in the post-mortem, and also the timing of the inquest. I mean, the inquest took 10 years to come about. That's because the Royal Coroner was controlling that.
John Morgan speaking to me from Australia there earlier this week, and he's the author of the book which is just out, part four of his volumes, all about the cover-up, as he calls it, and it's actually called this time The British Cover-Up, and it looks at some of the things that happened after the death of Diana itself. Martin Summers, this is a great story for Friday the 13th, isn't it, don't you think? And what are your thoughts about this whole aspect he was talking about there about the landmines being as a motive?
Well, I mean, I listen with interest to what he's saying. I mean, we were talking about the 7-7 inquest earlier. The J7 blog looks at many aspects related to that. People can look it up on the internet.
This is the July the 7th Truth Campaign.
Yes, J7, 7-7. If you do a search, you'll find it. I think for people have got interest in particular incidents, whether it's the London bombings, the assassination of Diana, if that's what it was, the Bologna bombing I mentioned earlier, the Brabant massacres. There's the bombings of Dublin and Monaghan in 1970. Frankly, there's a whole list of things that people could take an interest in, but they need to start taking interest in at least one or two of these things, and then they'll start to get the picture of what we're dealing with. The state is corrupt.
Well, there's also another aspect to this whole Diana business at the moment, for whatever reason, coincidentally, I think probably as a sort of part of the fallout after the inquest, there's a film just coming out called Unlawful Killing, which has been being shown at Cannes, and the director of that is Keith Allen. He says that part of one of the things that's in that documentary is a photograph of Diana, and as John Morgan was saying just there, straight after the accident, it didn't look like a photograph of a woman who was about to die.
Yes, well, Keith Allen, of course, is Lily Allen's dad, the pop singer.
And he says he's been all around the British television companies trying to get this commissioned.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's Mohammed Al-Fayed who has funded this film.
That's why he had to go
mean,
to
that doesn't mean it's a bad film. I'm just pointing out that
That's why he had to go to Al-Fayed to raise the money to make the film, is because he went to all of the British television networks, including Sky, Channel 4, to try and get this thing commissioned, and they all basically blanked him. Why aren't we seeing these proper investigative documentaries into these things these days, then?
Well, because, as you know, the media are part of the control mechanism. I mean, the terrorists, if that's what we can call them inside the state, also control the narratives that are allowed to proliferate.
This
about
all sounds a little bit Stalinist.
It's not Stalinist. In a Stalinist state, they don't bother with this. They just tell people what to do, and if you don't like it, you go to Siberia.
But it's certainly not free press, is there,
in Stalinist? No, what we've got is a semi-free society where people have to have the wool pulled over their eyes. That's why we have these terrorist incidents followed by narratives. So, for example, the Osama bin Laden narrative that we've been subjected to over the last few days, even though they can't make up their mind whether he was shot in one side of the head or the other side of the head, whether he's armed or unarmed, the body's nowhere to be found. But everybody out there presumes that if the government's going on about this, then it must be true. It's not necessarily so.
Okay, on to this iodine, potassium iodide story then, to be precise. And the reason that I've taken a bit of an interest in this is that potassium iodate tablets can be extremely useful if there's a nuclear leak. And looking at the possibility of nuclear clouds after the Fukushima incident, after the Japanese tsunami, I was quite worried to discover that actually for years and years potassium iodate tablets were available very cheaply and over the counter at chemists without prescriptions. Now they're almost totally unobtainable. So I've asked for a statement from Bristol City Council about the availability of these tablets in case we have either a terrorist attack at one of our local nuclear power stations, or else we get a fallout cloud from some other part of the world dropping down on the city here. So anyway, Pete at Bristol City Council tells us that specifically for Oldbury Nuclear Power Plant, there's an information calendar distributed by South Gloucestershire Council and Magnox, who run it, regarding safety information for people living and working within 3 kilometres of the site. So they're certainly interested in people who are living within 3 kilometres of the site, but not necessarily outside. Stable, non-radioactive iodine tablets and instructions for their use have been pre-distributed by the South Gloucestershire Primary Care Trust to householders within 1 kilometre radius of the site. So there must be not a lot of people who have had those. In the highly unlikely, in brackets, event, incident at Oldbury that required further distribution of potassium iodate tablets to the public, the decision would be taken by the strategic incident commander, usually a senior policeman, under advice and consultation from specialists at Oldbury Nuclear Power Station and partner organisations, which are not specified. As potassium iodate is a medical countermeasure, its distribution must be given under proper medical authority from a primary care trust. Well, that is peculiar because it's certainly not a prescription drug, and one would have thought that it should still be possible to buy this stuff ordinarily, you know, sort of over the counter, but unfortunately we're not allowed to do that. Households will be informed by South Gloucestershire Primary Care Trust when and how to take the potassium iodate tablets. And one of the reasons why this is so important is because we have very, very bad levels of iodine in our systems, where we're told in various cases that there is massive iodine deficiency in the UK. Anyway, thanks to all our guests today. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a happy and enjoyable weekend on Friday the 13th, which was originally the date when the Knights Templar were arrested back in the 13th of October 1307, which was a Friday. See you next week.
CFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol